Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of Hess to order. Present are Representative Carr, Representative Steve, Representative Talrico, Representative Foster, Representative Wool, myself, Chair Seaton. I'd like to remind everybody up their cell phones. And today we're going to be the second hearing of HB 148 Medical Assistance Coverage Reform. And we will start with the continued introduction of the bill. And what we're going to do is the fiscal note section first, and then we will come back to a more in-depth description of the sections that members needed clarified or further comments on those. And members have in their packet several amendments proposed by the office. Those are already online for members of the public. If the discussion of the bill seems to relate closely to an amendment, a motion might be made. But it's my intention to take up not to take up significant committee time today moving in all the proposed amendments, but just to make the aware of what amendments are being considered so that when we move into public testimony, we will have they'll have the ability to comment on those as well. At the end of the meeting, we're going to hear about 15 minutes or so of public testimony, and that will be limited to 3 minutes, but there may be an opportunity, or there will be an opportunity to ask questions of those testifiers. And then Saturday meeting coming up, that's the main intent, is to take public testimony at that time. And we may introduce some amendments if time allows, but the focus will be on public testimony. And we plan on the meeting running late, so we're planning from 3 to 6. Previously it was announced as 3 to 5, but we may take an additional hour, but we will gavel out at 6 p.m. For other activities. And then on Tuesday, we'll meet at the regular time that we have, and then we will take an at-ease till about 5, or at about 5, and then at 6 return to complete our discussions. And we're hoping to, bring that back up, the bill up at that time, and move forward. So all the committee members, anything that we need to bring up first, seeing nothing. Welcome, Commissioner, and I just know John right now. Sherwood. And Mr. Sherwood. And would you introduce yourselves for the record and go ahead, and then we will start with the fiscal notes.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Arnoja Galo, Kamishamaganan, Valerie Davidson, Commissioner Designee of the Department of Health and Social Services. And with me today,
this is John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. So I think I'm going to go through the fiscal notes just to provide a little bit of summary of overall for the fiscal notes from the department. We're talking about an FY16 appropriation of over $146 million and actual reduction in UGF of over $2 million. And then in the out years, in 2021, total expenditure would rise to $215 million, and then reduction in undesignated general fund of almost $98 million. So I was going to walk through each of the fiscal notes individually, very briefly, and answer questions, and just go in order, the number order that was assigned to them. So, and number one is actually a Department of Administration fiscal note around. It's a small increase for the Office of Administrative Hearings. Number two is Department of Corrections reflecting.
Just a minute before we want to go through this. Are there any questions that members have on the fiscal note for the Office of Administrative Hearings? Okay, I don't see any. Mr. Sherwood, go ahead.
Thank you. Number two is, again, it's not our department, it's the Department of Corrections, and this would be a reduction in expenditures as a result of the expansion. Inmates who receive inpatient care could become eligible for Medicaid coverage while they're actually getting the inpatient treatment when they're physically out of the correctional facility overnight. And so this would allow Department of Corrections to bill those expenditures to Medicaid.
And John, can you go through, we see $4,100,000 for FY16 and then $7 million after that. Why the difference in the years?
I would defer to the Department of Corrections. My understanding is they just don't really anticipate to be able to bring this up and achieve the maximum savings in year one as they get, I think part of it may have to do with their payments. They may be paying for care that's already provided in the previous year, but also they may not be able to get everyone enrolled in the early part of the year.
And is there anything with corrections on recidivism or being able to provide behavioral health services as they exit the correction system but are still on probation?
Mr. Chair, I believe there's certainly potential for savings there, but I do not believe that this fiscal note reflects savings associated with that. Again, I would defer to the Department of Corrections if they have somebody available.
Okay, and Representative Will, and I believe Corrections is online, so we'll, but Representative Will, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess along the same line, so $7 million in savings, basically that is just for overnight hospital stays for prisoners in state custody, not a day trip to get chemotherapy or dialysis or anything like that. It has to be overnight, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, that's correct. They have to be actually staying out of the facility overnight so that they're no longer considered to be residing in the facility on that day.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to add a little bit on that point, we discussed this, of course, in the Department of Corrections Budget Subcommittee this year and the potential for savings. And one thing that they pointed out is they have an aging population. And so, as far as those extended stay type of care experiences, that's part of the issue here is that as your population is, aging over time, then the health care needs are more significant.
And I believe that we have corrections in the room as well as online. Who would be the appropriate person? Online we have Laura Brooks, and I believe there may be somebody in the room, and they're coming forward. And let's just bring another chair up in case there's other people that are, so you guys don't have to leave. We've got a roller chair right over here. That's okay. Thank you. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ramon Henderson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections.
And did you hear the questions that we had asked?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair. With respect to the first question in terms of the $4 million in FY, $4.1 million in FY16 and the $7 million in the out years, the Deputy Commissioner for Health and Social Services is correct that in that we don't think that we will be ramped up fully in the first year, and so this is about 50% of what we think we'll be able to achieve in savings in the first year. In the out years, $7 million. We did do an analysis of pulling actual medical bills and looking at those individuals in FY 12, 13, 14, and 15, and looked at what those amounts would be for individuals that were institutionalized into a hospital for 24 hours or more. And these estimates that we arrived at here, we're looking at 80 to 90% of what we saw. For example, in FY 14, we saw that there were $8.5 million that were spent for individuals that were in care for 24 hours or more. And we think that the 90%, the $7 million in the out years, is representative of that. We also looked at FY15 And we have, through January, we've already seen $5.5 million of people that would be potentially eligible under Medicaid. And that equates to almost $9 million. So $7 million is a reasonable amount, we believe.
Thank you. And the other question that was posed was, is there anything the corrections is looking at as far as behavioral health follow-up as people transition out of the prisons and into probation?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to defer that one. We do think there's a link, but Laura Brooks, who is our medical director, is online, and she could answer that question for you.
Okay. Laura, are you online there, Ms. Brooks?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am online.
And did you hear the question?
I did. I think I understand the question, sir. And what we have in the Department of Corrections is we do have a number of staff who work to link offenders who are leaving our facilities, link them to the communities and the community resources. And so with this, we will be, if we can ensure that these individuals in custody are set up and ready to go for Medicaid upon release, there will not be a lapse in services as we oftentimes experience now. That, however, in terms of a fiscal note, I don't believe that is going to result in any direct savings to the department, because those are services that are already provided in the community. But there is some research out there that talks about those who have their criminogenic needs met, which includes things like stable medical and behavioral health care, that reduces the likelihood of them returning to corrections and reduces recidivism in the long run.
Okay, so there's an anticipated savings. It's indeterminate at this time, but it's indeterminate and it's not in the fiscal note here. Is that that's what I'm hearing?
That's correct.
That's correct. For those out in the community, yes.
Thank you very much. Anyone else have any other questions? Thank you.
And for the record, once again, this is John Sherwood with the Department of Health and Social Services. Fiscal note number three is a fiscal note for Behavioral Health Administration. It's essentially the cost of adding one position for around the provision of the 1915I option, which would be able to cover individuals, both some individuals currently served through Senior and Disability Services and grant programs, but also individuals under behavioral health. You're allowed to design essentially different benefit packages for different populations under that option. They anticipate it would they'd require one person for both the development and then the ongoing operation and maintenance of that component. It starts at 120 $1,400, which includes some one-time expenses for adding the position, and then it goes down to 112.8 in the subsequent years.
Do we have any questions? Do you anticipate that employee being in any particular place?
Mr. Chair, I don't. I'll turn to my, see if one of my lifelines can answer that question.
Aha, donuts. Something to keep us awake on Saturday, sugar high. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
For the record, my name is Albert Wall. I am the director of the Division of Behavioral Health. That position is anticipated to be in Anchorage, if you're asking the geographical location.
And then that will be in contact, I guess, but that one position we'll be doing, whether somebody's coming out of Juneau or Fairbanks or anything else?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to understand this a little better, the staffing is called a Health Program Manager 2. And just, I'm just not familiar enough with those different, like, sort of classifications of employees. And I wondered if you could just describe that kind of position.
Representative Tarr through the chair. The health program manager, too, is able to handle a wide variety of issues, both policy, regulatory, and in doing program oversight for different types of programs that are health-related. We use them for our program approval and oversight that is not specifically for a clinical position, mm-hmm. which we have to have a mental health clinician do. Mm-hmm. This one would be more on the end of the regulatory and policy writing.
Mm-hmm. And just a brief follow-up.
Representative Tarr.
And so this would just be an individual, though, who's experienced in healthcare. I mean, it sounds like it's a higher-level position, I guess, and based on the pay, too. That's why I was just...
Representative Tarr, through the chair, absolutely. This position will require a very high level of expertise in Medicaid services
okay.
and the regulations and that govern those services.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Mr. Ball. And John, backing up one more time, you said there were two services. One would be under senior and disability services, and the other portion of this would be, is that the 115I?
Mr. Chair, the two division services that are currently provided by general funds could be put under 1915I. One was the Division of Behavioral Health. The other was the Division of Senior and Disability Services. So you can serve different populations under this option. Examples would be individuals with dementia, individuals with traumatic brain injury, some individuals with developmental disabilities who don't meet the institutional criteria for service under one of our existing waivers, but also individuals with severe mental illness or other behavioral issues might qualify. So.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Fiscal note number four is the behavioral health treatment and recovery grants component. That are the general fund services, some of which could be shifted to Medicaid under 1915I, but also with the expansion itself, as individuals who are not currently eligible for Medicaid but have behavioral health needs are able to get Medicaid through the expansion, we anticipate a reduction for the to the grants as a result of them now being able to obtain their services funded through Medicaid instead of through the grants. And that starts out approximately a $1.6 million reduction, a little bit less than that, and then growing in FY 2021 to $19,584,000. Again, that's a combination of both the expansion, which would be FY 16 and 17, and then in 18, you also see the reductions related to adding 1915I.
Are there questions on fiscal four? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in this fiscal year, the smaller amount is because part of that transition is this is because in this year some of those folks that are grant recipients will have to transition to do Medicaid billing, and so that's sort of like the smooth transition piece of it, is that it doesn't happen immediately.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, yes, and we don't have a way to effectively compel everyone to come in and identify themselves as potentially Medicaid eligible and apply on the first day either. So mm-hmm. We expect that it'll, in this population, it may take a little bit of time mm-hmm. to get folks into the system.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Don't see any other questions. Go ahead.
Thank you. Fiscal law number five, behavioral health Medicaid services. This is the actual increase to the Medicaid expenditures around behavioral health. And again, like the grants, it stems from two sources, the expansion, which starts in FY 16, and then the addition of 1915I services, which would begin in FY 2018. And you can see it's almost $4.8 million in FY 16, growing eventually to 26.6 million for FY 2021.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you said this includes eye services, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, yes, 1915 eye services.
Okay.
So right. The eye option.
For the behavioral.
For the behavioral health side of it.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for my as a reminder for myself, when we look in the out years, right, the first year there's no general fund match because we're at 100% federal reimbursement. And then without running the numbers, the GF match that we see in those out years is when we go from 100 down to 99 to, or however that steps down, right?
Through the chair, Representative Parr, thank you for asking me that question, because as we switch to Medicaid services, there is a point I want to make. The expansion is initially 100% federal, and it does step down over this period to 90%, or with the retention of the 100% tribal match, our match rate will always be effectively higher. But to be clear, the 1915 I services will go predominantly to people who may already be Medicaid eligible, but who do not meet an institutional level mm-hmm. of care to mm-hmm. get our waiver services. Mm-hmm. So those services we anticipate will be provided pretty much at the base match rate of 50%. I believe in this fiscal note, behavioral health, because they serve individuals on Denali Kid Care and some through tribal systems, averages about 56% federal. Mm-hmm. But the 1915 I services are not at the same enhanced match rate that the expansion services
That's
are.
Fine. Okay, perfect. So. Thank you.
Are there further questions? Seeing none, go ahead.
Okay, the next fiscal note number 6 is adult preventive dental Medicaid services, and this fiscal note is just to reflect that portion of adult the portion of the increase in spending related to Medicaid expansion for this particular allocation in the Medicaid services budget. So we allocate adult preventive dental medical services separately, and this expansion population serves the adult, would include the adult, is targeted on the adult population, and so a portion of the expenditures would fall into this Medicaid services component.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this adult preventative dental Medicaid, is that currently part of the Medicaid services? It seems to me, let me rephrase that. It seems to me in one of the presentations that you gave us, you indicated in, I think it was the 1990s, that was one of the items that was cut out in order to save money. So are you telling me in this expansion that you're putting it back in?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, actually it was, our adult dental service was cut out in the 90s and was restored later in the 90s. And then this is actually, but that service that was cut was actually what we referred to as emergency dental or coverage of acute pain and infection. This is an enhanced dental service for adults that was added by the legislature, I believe, in the early 2000s. And it goes beyond that sort of emergency care, the kind of care that would basically put you in the hospital or the emergency room if left untreated, and provides the other sorts of dental services, basic, you know, filling of cavities, restoration work. We also cover dentures under this option as well. So It is provided available to individuals and to adults, and has been for, I think, about 10 years now.
So follow-up, Representative Stute.
Yes, thank you. And it also appears that it's preventative also, so I would presume that's cleaning and those type of things, your average dental work. One more, thank you, through the chair. Do you know how many states provide dental coverage by any chance?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, I don't know how many do for adults. It is an optional service for adults. We should be able to locate that information, but I don't happen to know.
I'd be grateful. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and you'll provide that to the committee, and we'll get it to everyone. Are there any other questions? Proceed along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fiscal note number 7 is health care Medicaid services. Health care Medicaid services covers the bulk of our primary and acute care that we provide through the Medicaid program. There are two things shown in this fiscal note. One is the increase in the net increase in Medicaid spending as a result of adding the expansion group. The other is the impacts of the 1115 demonstration waiver for tribal services. That's the provision is included in the bill, and the expansion starts immediately in FY16. And then we anticipate some savings from the 1115 waiver in 2017 and continuing on and really ramping up through 2021. And to be clear on that waiver, we see the net impact of that is not an increase in Medicaid spending, but shifting Medicaid spending from non-tribal facilities to tribal facilities, and so we're projecting a change in the federal match rate. So this would be an amount of service that would be being paid 50% general funds to 0% general funds. And so that's why when you look at the total operating expenditures line, and then you look at the federal receipts increase more than the total expenditures do. And even though there would be a required general fund match for the expansion piece, the total general fund match is actually a reduction, because we'd be reducing the amount that we need for those services provided to tribal members that would be served in the waiver. So I know that's kind of a lot to track, and so if you want to take a minute, I would understand.
Are there questions? I don't see any.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fiscal note number 8 is senior and disability Medicaid services. Again, this is two pieces. It's a small amount of the total projected expenditure for expansion allocated to senior and disabilities Medicaid services. And then beginning in FY18, it would be a more substantial increase, as we anticipate bringing in the 1915i option. In addition, also in the bill, as you may recall, is the 1915k option, in which we could convert some services from our current home and community-based waivers to the K option and get an extra 6% of federal match. So there's actually three things going on in this fiscal note. There's the expansion, there is the 1915I increase, which again is offset by reductions to grant programs that we will get to in subsequent fiscal notes. And then there is the K option, which shifts money from general funds to federal funds. And those three things go on, and you can see it's $2.9 million in the first year is the total expenditure, and then by 2021, total expenditure is up to $21.3 million.
There are questions? Don't see any. So.
Thank you. Fiscal note number 9 is reductions for the CAMA program, chronic and acute medical assistance. Almost all of the individuals who are eligible for CAMA right now would be eligible for the Medicaid expansion, and we anticipate in the first year we'd be able to move about two-thirds of the cost out of the CAMA program and into the Medicaid expansion, and in the eventually going up to $1,471,000 in being able to reduce CAMA as a result of the expansion.
On some of the other fiscal notes, I saw the number of participants. I don't. Do you know if the number of participants is here as well?
500.
If
I'm not.
Top of the back.
Mr. Chair, it is in the analysis. It's under 500.
Thank you. Are there other questions? No.
Fiscal note number 10 is medical assistance administration. This is the component of the administrative side of healthcare services. And so this includes staffing for both the expansion and for the 1115 demonstration waiver, which would be added one position, which would be added in FY 2018 for the waiver. 1115 demonstration waivers typically come with a pretty extensive amount of federal oversight and data reporting, so we would anticipate if we were doing a waiver, we'd need an additional person to really maintain and collect and track that information and provide it to the federal government. And then the other four positions would be around the Medicaid expansion.
Any questions? Seeing none.
Fiscal note number 11 is a fiscal note for our Office of Rate Review. It's a very small fiscal note of $4,500. One provision of the bill has to do with evaluating and developing a proposal for a provider tax, and this is some funding for some meetings in Juneau and Fairbanks. We would anticipate doing the work and absorbing most of the costs with our existing staff and budget, but we did put in some funding to have stakeholder meetings in two locations. Our staff for this office is based in Anchorage, so we didn't put any funding in for a meeting in Anchorage or in the Anchorage area.
Don't see any questions there. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add to this, we recognize that implementing a provider tax is something that is definitely complicated. Other states have done it, but we feel that since Alaska hasn't had a provider tax, we're actually working on an RFP right now using FY15 funds to be able to put out an RFP to be able to secure an independent contractor who can come to us, do the analysis of what other states have done, look at the Alaska information to help us to develop recommendations for provider tax that might work in Alaska.
Well, good, because we've got an amendment to move us in that direction with third-party analysis as well. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so the person who successfully, wins that bid for the contract, that person would work in conjunction with the staff shown here to do these stakeholder meetings and make that all work right.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that's correct. We anticipate that, so the RFP process is starting right now. We recognize that in order to be ready to be able to deliver the report and the timelines reflected in this legislation, that we really need to get started now in fiscal year 15 so that we can do that now. So we're using FY15 funds to be able to accomplish that, and so that independent contractor dollar amount is not included in this FY16 fiscal note because we're using existing FY15 funds to be able to accomplish that.
Brief follow-up.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed that there's a 50% federal match on this, and just I'm not remembering at this time. Part of Medicaid expansion includes administrative support. And is that only available for FY17, or if we had additional things we needed to work on in the following year, is some of that administrative support dollars still available?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, we can receive funding for administrative activities of Medicaid ongoing. Mm-hmm. There's no, in terms of 50% federal match, that's the standard percent for Medicaid. Administrative expenses that is available to us this year and into the for you know throughout the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you.
And just for members' notation, we did send around about a 5 or 6 page document on provider taxes and the complications and the federal requirements on those. So. Just as backup for why such a outside help might be necessary. Yeah. Any other questions? Seeing none. Oh, yeah, Representative Stutes.
Thank you. I might be a little premature in this question, so please forgive me if I am and let me know. But I notice on fiscal note 10, there's it provides for 5 additional staff members. I didn't notice any other provision for staff members on any of the other fiscal notes, but in an earlier presentation we were told it would take approximately 26 new staff people to facilitate this expansion. So I'm curious how we're going to pay for the other 21 staff members that are going to be required. Or maybe I'm not seeing it.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, we will get to additional positions in later fiscal notes. We're not done with our fiscal notes yet.
Okay, all right.
And the big one for positions is coming.
So. Okay, thank you. Well, forgive my prematureness on my question then.
Go ahead. I don't see any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fiscal note 12 is community developmental disabilities grants in the Division of Senior and Disability Services. And these are anticipated reductions in grants for services that would be able to be provided through the 1915I option. So, and that's a pure general fund reduction since they're state grant programs. Fiscal note 13 is similar. It's senior community-based grants. And that's a reduction for 1915I in a different grant component in the Senior and Disability Services budget.
And are there any questions on 15? Seeing none.
Fiscal note 14 is another Senior and Disability Services program. It's generally temporary assisted living. This is not actually a grant program, but it's an entitlement program for individuals who come typically because they're considered vulnerable adults. They need assisted living care, and they have needs that can't be met in a regular community setting. If they're not eligible for Medicaid coverage of that care, we provide that care through this program. And with the implementation of 1915I, we believe that we would be able to reduce, not eliminate, but reduce the amount of individuals we would have to cover through the General Relief Assisted Living Program by moving a substantial number onto the 1915I option.
And so under this fiscal note, this isn't the full amount of the program. This is just the amount that we anticipated a change after this bill.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I believe the full amount of the program is just under $8 million. Fiscal note 15 is Senior and Disability Services Administration, and that is largely around 1915I, but also to some extent 1915K. There are some system changes that would be required to the division's information system that they call the automated service plan, as well as in the first year, one additional staff person for the development of 1915 I and K. And then as the I and K come up, they would need additional staff people. They are projecting in the out years a total of 3 staff people, and a distinction between Senior Disability Services and the Division of Behavioral Health. The 1915I option requires an application of an assessment, and currently for the individuals receiving the senior grants, they don't receive a comparable assessment, so there would be some increase in the amount of assessments that would have to be done for this population that doesn't occur in the behavioral health population. So that's why there's a difference in the amount of staffing between the two divisions. So. And then fiscal note number 16, the last fiscal note, is the Public Assistance Field Services fiscal note. This is the administration and eligibility determination for people who are going to be covered through the expansion, the increase in work. And there, the anticipation is an addition of 23 additional positions beginning in FY16 and at a cost with the first year, the startup cost, it assumes $2,771,300, and then in the out years, it's $2,341,200. And you can see that that's 50% state and 50% federally funded.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But that does not include the 5 people from fiscal note 10. Is that correct? So it would be a total of 28 people?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, there's a couple of other positions in other fiscal notes. It starts out as in FY16, the cumulative total, according to my cheat sheet, is 29 positions, going to 31 in 2017, 32 in 2018 and 2019, and then 33 in 2020 and 2021.
Are there further questions? Representative Stutes.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to get my arms around this here.
And Representative Stutes, I just want to make sure that the whole committee knows that we're going as slow as we need to, because we want to cover this and understand it fully at one time instead of trying to circle back. So no problem at all. So Representative Stutes.
I'm going to ask a question, and I'm not sure that you can even answer it or provide the information, but here is my question. So currently it costs the state so many dollars per individual, basically, you know, a ballpark for each individual that's covered by Medicaid, correct? Do you have any figures that would show what it's going to cost the state to cover that same individual starting in 2016 up through 2021 with Medicaid expansion in effect?
And Let me just clarify to see if I understand the question. Are you talking about the average recipient, or are you talking about the current recipients and whether Medicaid expansion will change the cost for current recipients?
No, I'm talking about what the state is paying right now today for one individual. However many there are, there's going to be an average cost per individual. After the expansion, even with more people, there is still going to be an average cost with the projected increase of people. And I would like to see what, and I realize this is a ballpark figure. Nobody has a crystal ball here. But I would like to see what the average cost would be from 2016 through 2021 for that same individual with Medicaid expansion in effect.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, I believe we can calculate that number. I can tell you that the average cost for the average recipient adding expansion will reduce the average cost per individual on Medicaid, because we expect that the expansion group is going to be lower average cost than our average Medicaid recipient. So, but we can look and calculate, try and calculate what that difference will be. But I can tell you that since this is one of the less expensive populations to serve, we do expect that the average cost would go down and not up.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And just to clarify that a little bit, the expansion population are single adults between the ages of 19 and 64?
That's correct, 19 and 64.
And so that's why the expansion population would be generally assumed to be those that are in a healthier range, where we're not getting into old age problems, and we've covered children under the CHIP program previously, or adults with young children.
Mr. Chair, yes, you know, our expensive populations, the most expensive populations to serve are the elderly and individuals with disabilities, the population over 65 is not eligible for the expansion, and people with disabilities with the most substantial disabilities and low incomes would already be covered by Medicaid through one of the categories that covers adults with disabilities. This population, we believe, is much more comparable to our population of adults who are on Medicaid, because they are parents of children, and that historically has been a less expensive population for us to serve. So I think that's a long way of saying yes, you're correct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stutes.
Follow up, for clarification. So on the second group of people, it would be an average of all people covered by Medicaid, not just the new expansion. Okay, I just wanted to make sure that I made myself clear. Sometimes I'm not, don't make myself perfectly clear. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may add to Deputy Commissioner Sherwood's comment, one of the things that that Evergreen Economics found when they did the analysis of the expansion population, found that the 54% of the eligible expansion population are male or men, and 20% of that group is between 19 to 34 years of age. So men and younger men, who are typically the lowest cost beneficiary to be able to cover. So we do expect, as Deputy Commissioner Sherwood indicated, for the average cost to actually decrease, because we are adding a pool to this population that is, quite frankly, cheaper to cover.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. And
Tar. Also, that you didn't mention, but not that you don't know it, but of this added population, the reimbursement rate is much higher, so that should further lower the average cost per Medicaid recipient, expansion and non-expansion population, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, it would lower the average general fund cost. The total cost of providing coverage would be equal, but the general funds, because the federal match rate is much better, the general funds would be average general funds per person would be much lower, and that so would lower the average general funds even more than it would lower the overall average.
Okay,
follow up.
Okay, because everyone's asking what the average cost is per recipient. And I think maybe what a lot of people in this building want to know is what the average cost is for the state per recipient. Mm-hmm. So although they might consume $7,000 worth of services, what is the state responsible for? So they added the expansion population getting a 90% at worst, 100% at best reimbursement is going to further lower the expense. And I can't speak for Representative Stutes, but maybe she was trying to get at that number as far as like what the state is on the hook for.
And I think that we want both sets of numbers. So if you could give us a table with the average cost per that is provided in Medicaid, and then what is the average cost in state general funds for the population. So both of those numbers over the, and if you can do that, estimated over that those year spans, that would be helpful. Does that work?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we can provide that.
Okay. Representative Wolf.
Last short follow-up. So what, based on the numbers that we've gotten from you guys, from Margaret Brody the other day, I think she said there's 138,000 people in the state currently receiving Medicaid services, and what we're talking about now is expanding maybe another 20 to 27,000 over the next 5 or 6 years. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, yes, although I think the 138,000 number she referred to is the number of people who actually receive services.
Right.
The number we're talking about adding, we're talking about adding number of enrollees, so not everyone who enrolls may receive a service that year. It's probably a little bit... And I apologize, I don't have that number in front of me. I think for that year, it was in over 150,000 actual enrollees for the 138,000 recipients. But we can also get the specific numbers.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and just to follow up, you know, we're talking 2027, but we've also asked for the numbers with the full 40,000 numbers to make sure how that would look as well. So mm-hmm. just to make sure that we're considering what the effect of 100% enrollment would be. Okay, so are there any other questions on fiscal notes? Seeing none.
Mr. Chairman, hello. Hi. I always like to ask questions.
Well, we have just asked the department to come back with an average cost per person, and we also the average general fund costs. So, Mr. Sherwood, could you go ahead?
Yes, to the chair, Representative Vasquez. In FY16, the total amount. Total expenditures for the all of fiscal notes for the Department of Health and Social Services. I don't actually have the other two departments' fiscal notes added in. Is $146,549,600. That figure grows over the next 5 years until 2021. It's $260,900. And of that, the federal portion actually exceeds the total expenditures, and we would reduce general funds. We would reduce general funds in the amount of $2,320,800 in FY16, and going out by 2021, we would reduce general funds by $97,916,400.
Okay, thank you.
I reserve the right to ask more questions on this particular point, but thank you. Appreciate it.
So let's go back. No further questions on fiscal notes, I think. So let's go back to the bill itself. And we had gone through the sectional, I believe, and there were questions on the bill. I'm trying to remember exactly where we got to. When we got through the sectional, the committee went to go through the sectional with a little more detail on sectional, or do you want to go through the language of the bill?
Either way, Mr. Chairman. The last few sections we had to
rush.
We had to rush. Yeah. So let's go back to the sectional.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask one question, please, before we do that?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sherwood, you had previously provided to us, and I was just trying to find all my documents, because a previous member had asked in the questions and the answers you provided to us about if all newly eligible Medicaid expansion folks enrolled, the spending per enrollee would be $7,248. But then I think you also had information that that's everyone, but who we really expect to enroll, this sort of smaller group, puts it down at $6,560. And so we had those numbers in mind, but now I just wanted to compare that to what Representative Stutes is asking for. So those are the numbers separating out the expansion population, and now what she is asking is to take those people and put them into the overall population and average it. Is that the difference?
To the chair, Representative Tarr, I have to be honest. I don't think we ever estimated that the cost of our enrollees for the expansion population would be as low as $6,500 per year. I believe that was going back to the cost of the individuals, the adults that we currently serve through Family Medicaid, and we actually made a slight upward adjustment to reflect the fact that we knew some of the individuals would be moving over from CAMA, and those are individuals with chronic conditions that might be a little bit more expensive to serve than the Family Medicaid population.
Okay, thank you.
So I think that we were about on Section 7 where we started to rush last time.
Mr. Chair, so you'd like me to go through the sectional again and start beginning on Section 7?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay.
We wanted to get it on the table so that
right.
It was here, but we...
Right. Section 7 and 8 are, again, two technical amendments that we're making to the Medicaid statute, the eligibility statute. Certain individuals who receive long-term care services, nursing home services, home and community-based waivered services, are subject to a transfer of asset penalty if they give away assets without obtaining appropriate fair market value in return for those assets. There are some exceptions, situations where you can give away your assets, such as to a minor or a disabled child. But there are penalties that are imposed on those groups. And under the Affordable Care Act, they clarified that individuals who are determined eligible for Medicaid under the eligibility categories that use the MAGI income methodology, they're exempt from those transfer of asset penalties. And so this puts language in our statute that clearly shows that our statute around imposing transfer of asset is consistent with federal law on imposing penalties for transfer of asset.
And MAGI again was?
MAGI again, excuse me, is modified adjusted gross income. That's the new way we're to determine income for eligibility purposes for our children, our pregnant women, our parents and caretaker relatives in the Medicaid expansion group. It's not used for the categories that are specifically for the aged, blind, and disabled.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions on the asset transfer provisions of Section 7? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to understand a little better, and pardon me for needing to get my papers organized here. In some conditions, there's hold harmless provisions, but in general, the asset test applies for Medicaid, so this is more in line with that, the general provisions and updating that, and I apologize, I missed part of what you said.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, some Medicaid eligibility groups have asset limits in addition to income limits. Some do not, and as a result of the Affordable Care Act, all the eligibility categories that use the modified adjusted gross income or MAGI methodology are exempt from the asset test. So there is no asset test for those categories, and hence the argument that it doesn't make sense to apply a transfer of asset penalty to someone who gives away their assets when in fact they would have been eligible for Medicaid, whether they retained their assets or whether they gave away their assets.
Thank you. Representative Vasquez.
Yes, Mr. Sherwood, can you provide to the committee a table putting forth all of the programs that are dealt with under the MAGI system and those that are not?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, we can provide a breakout of which categories are determined through MAGI.
Okay, thank you. Representative Vasquez.
I realize that the federal government decided to make that change. Do you have any idea why they decided to do that, change to the MAGI and disregard all assets for certain categories of Medicaid recipients?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, I believe that the provide for a seamless transition between health care coverage through Medicaid and health care coverage through the health insurance exchange, the tax subsidies that are available to subsidize health insurance for individuals with incomes below 400% of the federal poverty level, use the same basic MAGI rules and do not have an asset test applied to determine whether or not they're eligible for those subsidies. And I think the notion was if you didn't use the same methodology and have the same asset requirements, then people would get kind of left out. Some people would get left out if their income increased, then they went to move into marketplace, or worse, if their income decreased, then they would have fallen into a Medicaid category, but there was a Medicaid requirement that made them ineligible for Medicaids, and so they wouldn't have coverage in either place. I think that was the basic logic, to provide for a fluid transfer in and out of the marketplace to and from Medicaid.
Representative Vasquez.
Isn't it true, that when you go to the exchange, assets are not considered when they determine subsidies, just based on income, isn't it true?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, yes. I was trying to say that, and if I misspoke, I apologize.
Okay, thank you.
So they're both determined the same way. The MAGI is used either with the exchange or with Medicaid.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Except for those certain special cases.
There are some special cases, but in general, they're determined the same way, and neither MAGI-based Medicaid or the exchange uses an asset test.
Okay. Thank you. I don't see any further questions. You want to go to Section 8?
Mr. Chair, Section 8 is just another one of the two sections that was amended for conformity with transfer of assets.
Okay, and go ahead then on to 9.
Section 9 and Section 10 outline the cost containment measures to be taken by the department, including seeking demonstration waivers. And let me just get the list in front of me so I don't forget it. It includes the 1115 demonstration waiver to look at ways to develop an innovative service delivery system to improve care, increase efficiencies, reduce costs, and expand services for Indian Health Service beneficiaries using services delivered through Indian Health Service and tribal health facilities. It also directs us to apply for the 1915I option to obtain the 50% federal match for home and community-based services that are now 100% general funded. Instructs us to apply for the 1915K option to provide the home and community-based services under that option at the enhanced federal match rate, the 6% increase in the match rate. Instructs us to evaluate and apply to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, to participate in various demonstration projects, including payment reform, care management programs, workforce development and innovation, and other innovative service delivery models. And it also instructs us to enhance our telemedicine capabilities and reimbursement to incentivize its use for Medicaid recipients.
Okay. Thank you. And does anyone have any questions on this section? These two sections, 9 and 10. Yes, Representative Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to put on the record that both of these sections, you know, the language is that the department shall do this, so it's not an optional thing for the department. So just that's clear that these would be for sure things that had to take place.
Seeing no other questions, go ahead to Section 11.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Both Section 11 and Section 12 make amendments to Alaska Statute 4707-900, the part of the Medicaid statutes which define the terms, and they effectively remove the requirement that behavioral health providers be a grantee of the state of Alaska, so you don't have to receive a behavioral health grant. This is language that's been in our statute for some time. It's not really viewed favorably by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and would potentially expand the pool of Medicaid behavioral health providers.
And are those grants kind of perfunctory? I mean, are they? At one point, I was hearing that some people receive a $100 grant, and then that means that they can provide services. Are these significant grants, or are these just to make sure that everybody that was doing that was
qualified? Mr. Chair, I think most of them are significant and substantial grants. I think there may have been times we have made small grants in the awareness that it would enable somebody to provide Medicaid services, but I would actually ask Director Wall to elaborate on that, because I think he knows his grant programs better.
Once again, for the record, my name is Albert Wall. I'm the Director of the Division of Behavior Health.
Yeah.
And Mr. Sherwood is correct, Mr. Chair. The majority of those grants are large grants that are given to our community treatment providers. There have been in the past small grants that allowed providers to enroll as Medicaid providers. But this removal of this language would allow for broader access to Medicare and the potential Medicaid, I apologize, and the potential enrollment of more providers in the system.
And is there anything within the removing of the grant language here that will be detrimental to any current behavioral health providers receiving grants?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. And there is a relationship with the providers that we have to maintain carefully. There are some concerns out there that the providers who are the licensed care providers who are individually members of the behavioral health agencies that provide services may go out on their own and provide services in that manner and leave the agencies that they're in. And so we're working with our associations to address that issue. The overall effect on the system of care will be a potential increase in the number of providers and more access for Alaskans for Medicaid.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stutz and then Tarr.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there certain requirements required by the department in order to be a provider? So if somebody is a licensed physician in mental health as a profession, is there anything that would prevent them from becoming, with this being removed, is there something that would prevent them from becoming a provider, or do they have to qualify?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, for all... Mr. Sherwood, we got two male voices up
okay.
here, so...
For the record, this is John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner. Through the chair, Representative Stutz, all Medicaid providers have to meet some kind of provider standard. In some cases, we simply use an existing standard. For instance, for physicians, we would use license to practice in the state. For some provider types that are not essentially licensed as such, we have to put forth our own standards, so our own criteria. So, for instance, the two services directly impacted, behavioral health clinic services and behavioral rehabilitation services, we would still need to establish standard through regulations and in our state plan, submit for approval with the by the federal government. The standards, they could be substantially the same as the standards that are used for currently for behavioral health grantees, or they could be somewhat different. And I guess I would let Al add to that if he...
I think the commissioner wants to.
I have a follow-up.
Okay, just a minute while they confer, we'll just let...
So, Mr. Chair, if I may add to that question, there is no other provider type in Medicaid that we require them to be a grant recipient before they can bill Medicaid. So if you're a physician providing physician services, if you're an OBGYN and you're providing OBGYN services, if you're another kind of provider providing health services for Medicaid, as long as you meet the provider requirements and you enroll as a Medicaid provider, you are able to bill for Medicaid. And behavioral health is the only program in which our state requires them to be a grantee. So we are removing that, we are proposing to remove that requirement in this legislation so that we don't require them to overcome that additional hurdle to be able to provide services. It would be akin to us saying to doctors, you're not able to bill for Medicaid unless you apply and receive a grant, a separate grant from the Department of Health and Social Services. At the time, it served some purpose, I'm sure, but as we've, and it's been on the books, on the statutes for quite some time, we don't believe it is no longer necessary. We have no other, we require that of no other providers, and we would like to remove it here.
Yep, thank you. Follow-up, Representative Stutz.
Thank you. And as you can probably see where I'm going with that questioning, it concerned me a little to hear that clinics now that are provider clinics are concerned about some of their licensees going out and practicing on their own. I would think that that would be a benefit cost-wise to the department. The more competition, the better the I'm just wanted to clarify that point. Thank you very much.
And then do we have Representative Tarr? And then Representative Vasquez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a brief question about this in terms of the kind of information we might get about the patients. And it seems to me that this might provide some better insight into sort of the types of services an individual is receiving. And we might, you know, through other opportunities with Medicaid expansion, we're working on the continuum of care, be able to even, you know, better address someone's health needs if we, you know, have a little more of this data. And I just wonder if you'd agree with that or think that that potential exists.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I agree with that statement.
And that's Mr. Wall. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Al Wall.
These voices, we just need to have who's speaking. So.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do agree with that statement. Right now, data is tracked on our clients for behavioral health through two separate systems, AK Ames and the enterprise system. That will continue, but the services will shift from one source to the other. Both of those systems have some different capacity for reporting, but we see that capacity growing in the future.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Vasquez.
I'm curious, why were these providers first required to be grantees before they could bill 1 cent to Medicaid?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, I think these, it's fair to say these provisions go back far enough, it's before all of our times. A decision was made in the development of these services that this provision would be put in statute, and I couldn't without doing the research on the legislative history, I couldn't tell you why.
Representative Vasquez.
So a behavioral health provider could get a grant and then at the same time bill Medicaid, basically. Because of that dual eligibility, yes. Right?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, grantees can provide services to individuals. If they're Medicaid eligible, they can bill Medicaid. I think there are provisions in the grant that would prohibit duplicative billing. I would defer to Al on the specifics, but generally that's a requirement of most of our grants, that if you're charging Medicaid, you're not also charging it off to the grant.
Representative Vasquez.
Then why have them be first able to get a grant if they're supposed to be before they can bill Medicaid? Why have this dual eligibility type of thing? So they're not allowed to bill both programs.
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, that's why we're trying to eliminate the provision. We don't see the need for having to have that requirement.
Okay, thanks. Representative Vasquez?
Mr. Wall, is there in, this is all in your division, do you have a database or software that identifies double billing? In other words, a provider billing grants at the same, getting grant money at the same time billing Medicaid?
Representative Vasquez, through the chair. The AKM system does track their clients in both systems, and we have a QA unit that does exactly that.
And have you called any providers?
Representative Vasquez, through the chair, I can't answer that specifically. I believe that there have been instances where we do investigations into cases and generally hand those over to the Medicaid Fraud Unit. The Division of Behavioral Health may encounter issues in their QA process, and then they hand that over to the Medicaid Fraud Unit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions on this. Would you go on, Mr. Sherwood?
Thank you. The next section is Section 13, which instructs the department to amend any state plan it has with the federal government to be consistent with this act. So essentially this requires us to make all the state Medicaid plan amendments, submit all the state Medicaid plan amendments, and the waiver, the 1115 waiver, would be essentially an addendum to our state plan, our Medicaid state plan. So it's really just instructing us to do what we know we have to do to keep it ourselves in federal compliance.
Thank you. And then I don't see any questions on that.
Section 14 authorizes the department to engage in emergency rulemaking under the Alaska Medicaid reform measures and provisions of this act. So there it allows us to be clear that we can move fast on some of these provisions and start implementing reforms and obtaining savings. And of course, trying to live within our means, the sooner we can get these in place, the sooner we can start achieving the savings.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no questions there. You have a question?
You know, historically, the courts have been very strict in allowing administrative agencies to issue emergency regulations. First of all, how much time do you expect you will be saving by using this mechanism?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, I don't know that we've calculated an average, but even a fairly swift-moving regulation process through the normal process wouldn't become effective for 3 or 4 months. And emergency regulations can be effective immediately. With regard to your comments about the courts, I think while we think that these situations can rise to the level of emergency, having it in statute simply eliminates one point of contention should some group try and obstruct our implementation of regulations or our use of emergency regulations.
Thank you. Further questions?
Yes. Since you do plan to implement this, if it passes immediately, what about notice to everyone in the community? I mean, this may affect a lot of people, thousands of people. Where's the due process on this by rushing it so fast?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, the emergency, the provisions in the Administrative Procedures Act for regulations do provide for a notice and a hearing, and essentially, in sort of simplistic terms, you replicate the normal process that you would go through to adopt regulations, but you're allowed to begin implementing them before that process is complete. So you put them into effect, and then you go through that process. That said, that's at the state level. There are still some notice requirements that would be have to met at the federal level. 30 days notice to changes in reimbursement for 30 days notice to providers, and then timely notice to recipients if you're going to make a change that would result in the elimination or reduction of any of their benefits.
Okay. Representative Vasquez.
Mr. Sherwood, can you give me the federal citation, both regulatory and statutory, that enables the department to immediately implement this bill without asking first for a change to the state plan from the feds?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, we can provide you with that site. I don't happen to remember the exact site that allows us to have state plan amendments effective in the quarter they're submitted. So we're still in the first quarter of this calendar year. So any state plan amendment we submitted before the end of March could have an effective date of January 1 of this year. Mm. That's the general principle. But we can find the citation for you.
And is January 1 of this year, you mean retroactive to the quarter?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Retroactive to the first day of the quarter in which the amendment is submitted. So on April 1, we could only go back to April. We could only start at April 1. But if we submitted it on March 31st, we could have a request an effective date of January 1 of 2015.
And the effective date of this in Section 17, is that July 1st, 2015? Am I missing?
Section 17, the effective date is July 1 of 2015, and that's the state. That's the state statutory effective date. I've been talking about the effective date as it relates to the Medicaid state plan we have to submit to the federal government for approval. So,
and that can be retroactive.
That can be retroactive based to the back to the first day of the quarter that in which we submit the amendment.
So just if it's submitted before, I mean, this has an effective date of July 1st, so nothing's going to be statewide effective before then. So as long as it didn't have an effective date before the 1st of July, I mean, we wouldn't be implementing something that before this statute has an effective date anyway,
right?
That's
correct. We wouldn't submit. There's nothing that precludes us in submitting the amendment prior to that date, but the effective date, because of state statute, would have to be on or after July 1 of 2015. But there's nothing about the federal rules that would allow us to go back before the state statute gave us authority.
Right. So I just want to make sure that this was really the implementation date is what we have in Section 17, no matter whether federal laws would let us go back and retroactively do something, you still wouldn't have the state statutory ability to have an effective before July 1st. Okay.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I was just getting confused.
We have to keep tracking all these dates in our head all the time, and it's pretty easy to get confused in which way you're counting forward or backward sometimes.
Thank you. Representative Tart, does anyone else have a question? I think that we were on, I skipped forward to 17 because I was confusing the dates. So I think we're on 15, is that correct? Section 15?
Yes. And Mr. Chair, Section 15 is an instruction to the reviser of statutes to make technical amendments to the title of AS 4707036 to conform to the amendments of this act. So the topic changed a little bit and instructs that the title be changed. Section 16 provides that immediate effective dates for sections 13 and 14, and those are the those are the sections that allow us to submit the state plan amendments and to begin developing emergency regulations. And as we've already discussed, Section 17 puts the effective date for the remainder of the bill at July 1, 2015.
So you could go ahead and submit the plan amendment. You could proceed along with emergency regulations, but they really wouldn't be effective until after Section 17 statutory date of the bill of July 1st.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Since the things we'd be trying to implement with those amendments or regulations wouldn't be effective until July 1, the effective dates of those provisions essentially wouldn't be before July 1.
Okay, thank you. We got to the end. Do we have any other questions on bill, on any parts of the bill that we didn't get over? Then in committee discussion, I would like to put on a couple of amendments on the out and at least put them on the table so we can discuss them. So I'm going to move amendment dot A dot 2, and would someone object? Thank you, Representative Tarr, objecting for discussion. And what does amendment A dot 2 do? This is a new bill section 9, which changes 4707030D regarding the primary care case management system or managed care organization for certain individuals from may, changing it from a permissive may to a shall, and includes the super utilizers as identified by the department as those eligible persons. And section 14 adds to the uncodified law the requirement that the department establish the primary care case management or managed care contract by January 1st, 2017, and will deliver a report or a plan or a contract to the legislature. And the reason we're doing this is the primary care management for super utilizers has been identified by the department as a large potential savings. However, AS 4707030D has been in statute without action, and that's with a may. And so what we're doing here was we're by changing may to shall, we tell the department that we and they are going to be committed to seeing action on that issue. And we recognize that the complications of travel and small population is not practical to institute case management system for the entire state, but the department has therefore been given leeway to select the type of care management that is used and which eligible individuals require the attention. So I just wanted to put that on the record, so that we knew where it is. There are some tweaks probably to that the department may want to come and work with us on. So I'm going to table this, set it aside, so that we can consider it another date. I want to get these issues out on the record as well for other committee members that might be thinking about proposing amendments so that we're not duplicating amendments if they fit within a program. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just wondered, because I think this is one of the reforms that's underway right now, and so I can understand, you know, you and the super utilizer issue have been following, and there's been, you know, several million dollars saved, and if with expansion of that effort, a few million more potentially to be saved. So you've been accomplishing that without any changes to that language and moving to that model. And just if you could sort of compare what you're doing now, if this changes that, or you know, if you feel like you could continue to enhance that reform measure without any language changes.
Did Chair Representative Barr, we don't think this is necessary to the changes are necessary to continue what we're doing, and we would intend to do that. On the other hand, the changes wouldn't interfere with what we're doing. So,
okay, thank you.
And just going back to that, the other part of this is it's going to require them to give a report to us so that there's some accountability to what they're proceeding with, and the legislature will know how that's progressing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions on A.2? We have amendment A.3, and oops, I better go back. And this was moved as amendment number 1. A.2 was amendment number 1, so if we come back and take it off the table, we'll know which one it is. We have amendment number A.3, and I will move amendment A.3.
Object.
And we have an objection for discussion here, and so 8.3 puts a new section into uncodified law requiring the department to report to the legislature the results of the Medicaid redesign and expansion technical assistance study. The report will include the program of reform that has resulted from that study, and it's due on or before the 10th day of the second regular session of the legislature. And why is this here? This is being proposed because the department has already committed to moving forward with a third-party consultant on Medicaid reform, but this report ensures that the legislature is going to get the report and stay abreast of the action. So, Mr. Sherwood, do you have any comment on A.3 as amendment number 2?
Mr. Chair, no real comment. We had intended to share the results of our work with our consultant with the legislature.
We have an objection. I'm not. Does anyone else have any discussion on requiring them to report the results of the report? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having just recently reviewed the RFP for what you're looking for, it looked as if we would get this information. I guess my only concern would be, how much additional staff time it might take to produce a report, or do you think what you will get from your contractor will be presented? It looked like the language said to, something that we could read. So does it seem like you'll take that report and we'll just repackage it and deliver it to the legislature?
To the Chair, Representative Tarr, yes, I think we wouldn't intend on doing substantially more work to provide it to the legislature.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may add to that, through the Chair, Representative Tarr, not only would we make the final report available to the legislature, but we might be able to, for example, condense it in a PowerPoint so that we can provide information to the legislature and to the public in a more condensed format so that the average person doesn't necessarily have time to read a comprehensive report, but we can give them what I still call the moral of the story as we're moving forward so that our commitment to transparency, the public can also understand the recommendations as well.
And just one brief follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tarr.
With the timeline, the RFP just closed. It's a pretty quick timeline, so this doesn't impact the timeline in which that contractor is going to provide this report back to us.
No. To the Chair, we don't see it impacting the timeline.
Okay.
And Representative Tarr, just for understanding, we've had reports that have been conducted by administrations in the past mm-hmm. that have then not been shared with the mm-hmm. legislature in a timely manner. Mm-hmm. And this is mm-hmm. just making sure that everybody understands that these reports will be shared with the legislature in a timely manner. And so the expectation is there, and we know that the administration isn't off doing something, and we may or may not find out about mm-hmm. it. I mean, and we've got good agreement, I think, with the mm-hmm. With the commissioner and the department. So,
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I know if we can successfully get this bill through, and they're going through the work of implementation, I was just wanting to make sure we didn't sort of take precious staff time away from that for something that we might have in another format. But I appreciate, because I know I can think of a very recent example where we were anxiously awaiting a report on this very topic. So
Representative Tarr, do you maintain your objection to amendment number 2, which is A.3?
I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any further objections to A.3? Representative Vasquez.
The bill provides for a pilot project, doesn't it, on case management? Which section is that?
It's the end of my
mm-hmm. Representative Vasquez, this is only dealing with the report of the Medicaid redesign and expansion technical assistance study.
Oh, okay. This is the report?
This is just the report of that study that gets done, that third-party study.
I have no objection to that.
Okay, thank you. And we will get, all right, so is there any other objection? Seeing no other objection, then A dot 2 is adopted. I want to restate that is amendment number 2, which is A dot 3. And we have other amendments that are in the package and also been provided to the public, and they're online so the public can view them, but we did want to take and go to get some public testimony in today, and so we're going to put consideration of the bill aside at this point and go to public testimony. And thank you very much. Was there any final statement that, and we will be back on Saturday.
Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, you have staff.
And let's see, we have signed in here Lisa Engelhardt, I believe. Can you tell me? I am. Didn't we have a list of testifiers here? Okay. From Douglas? Do we have a Lisa from Douglas that wanted to testify? Maybe she's left. Okay, so see, I believe we have Iona Farr. Welcome, and we don't have very long to testify, but go ahead and put yourself on the record. And if you have written testimony, that's great. Thank you, and we're going to try and get by in 3 minutes here.
Okay, I'm Dr. Ilona Farr, family practice. I serve on multiple boards, but I'm here representing myself and several family practice docs. WAMI graduate 1970, 83 was when I graduated. Basically, my concerns with this bill is I'm opposing the bill, first of all. Right now, when I was on the MRAG committee, we learned some interesting facts. This was going to cost the state $6.2 billion by 2032 without expansion. $2.8 billion from the state, $3.4 billion from the federal government. And my question is, where is this money going to come from? I'm also very concerned in this bill about the provider tax. Other states do have some of these taxes. There's 19 different categories, and I've actually got the study that was done in 2020. Federal government about these taxes in different states, and my concern is the impact on small businesses, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and physicians. Right now, most physicians costs with Medicaid. There's a lot more audits. There's a lot more regulations and requirements with Medicaid, and my concern is that you're going to drive those of us out of business. There's also a cost differential, too, where you have federal rules that decide who's going to get what. And when I was doing some research for the same visit, one provider could get paid in a large institution $540, where those of us in private practice could be paid approximately $50. So what you're going to do is you're going to drive those of us in private practice out of business, and you're going to increase large facilities and corporations. You have people now that are getting out of medical school that are $400,000 and $500,000 in debt. So it's going to be virtually impossible for them to be able to set up small private practices like I did. The other thing I have a lot of concerns about is right now we have between 140,000 and 160,000 patients on Medicaid. The studies do not really tell us how many patients are actually going to be there. I've seen studies saying the expansion is going to be 40,000. There's other studies that I have here that show 64,000. And if you actually look at the states that have expanded, it's usually been triple or quadruple that amount. And I've got some slides in here that will tell that. I'm also concerned about the audits, because audits can cost physicians a lot of money. I know one physician that got audited, spent $80,000 in 6 years fighting the audit, and he got it down to $20,000, but that's a lot of expense for one provider. I also think that the costs, there's a lot of costs associated with Medicaid. Right now, the facts that we were given was that about $7,500 per average individual, but once you get above the age of 65, the cost actually went up to $65,000. And so that's one of my concerns, because we have an increasing number of Medicare patients in our population, and we also have 2,000 hepatitis C patients, and their treatment is going to run about $300,000, and I have never seen that budgeted for. There's also individuals that are still on the list for Medicaid services that are not even being covered, and so I have concerns about that, because Medicaid was supposed to be a program for the elderly, the disabled, and right now we're increasing the program, and I'm just afraid it's going to cause the state of Alaska to really crash financially in the near future. I've got lots more I can say, but I don't know if I'm limited to 3 minutes or not.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, the 3 minutes is there. And if you wouldn't mind submitting written testimony to us, we'll make sure that everybody gets it.
I have all of these different studies that I can submit. I have the Healthy Alaska Catalyst for Reform, the Medicaid Expansion Lessons, Medicaid Provider Taxes, the Congressional Research Division I would like to submit. I have that letter. I've got the long-term forecast for Medicaid enrollment and spending, the MESA report. So I want to make sure that that gets into the file and people read it, because it was hard to find in online. The Lewin report is also one that I have here. Can I make one more comment?
Very quickly.
Okay, I'd like support for the WAMI program, and then I'd also like support for some of the provisions in House Bill 74, too.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see, next we have, let's see, who is it? Becky Holtberg.
For the record, my name is Becky Holtberg. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Pleasure to be back in front of you today. My testimony is in written form in front of you. Wanted to note that we've been working cooperatively with the department and with Representative Seaton on the provider tax language, and I'm happy to answer any questions about that issue. Provider taxes typically are hospital and nursing home taxes, although they can be applied to other providers. So ASHNA supports HB 148. Yes, we support the bill because it expands Medicaid, but we also support the bill because we strongly believe that our healthcare system must reform. Healthcare reform is real, it is possible, and it is obtainable. And that's what I'm going to talk about. This bill sets the framework to begin the process of meaningful Medicaid reform. I want to note that reform should not be a one-point-in-time occurrence. It is not a destination we arrive at. It is a process that we need to be going through every year. And states that have had good experience with cost containment look at their system and do reform every year. We're at a crossroads right now with important choices to make about Medicaid expansion and reform that will have fiscal and economic impacts, as well as impacts on people's lives. The choice to engage in meaningful reform is, I think, one of the most important choices that we can make at this crossroads. you and the legislature have told us that Medicaid must be reformed. We agree, and we're here today to tell you that we support these efforts and we're ready to partner with the state to achieve that goal. You've also asked us what reform means, so I want to give you two very quick examples before the hook comes out and I get pulled off the stage here. One is Peace Health Ketchikan, which received a CMS innovation grant for care coordination. The project saved money, it improved quality. Good outcomes, right? Well, not necessarily if you're the hospital, which spent money to lose money to improve care. Our financial incentives are not aligned. Our current payment system does not reward efficiency and quality, it rewards volume. Medicaid reform helps to change that dynamic to align incentives. Central Peninsula Hospital in Soldotna is considering the formation of a coordinated care organization pilot. The CCO would be paid a global payment to take care of all of the health care needs for a defined population. There would be metrics and accountability for quality and outcomes. Within that global budget, the CCO is empowered to shift resources where they are needed to improve to ensure optimal cost and quality outcomes. The CCO takes risk. If costs exceed the budget, they eat it. But if they can manage care more efficiently with better quality outcomes, they are rewarded. Incentives are aligned. That is the destination. Medicaid expansion will provide health care for those who could never afford it, transforming lives. Medicaid expansion is also the engine of healthcare transformation, which benefits all of us. Innovation requires investment, and if we are going to transform the healthcare system, we need the risk capital to invest in those transformative efforts. Medicaid expansion through reduction in uncompensated care provides the risk capital that will enable us to continue that journey. So we need risk capital, but we also need healthcare reform, because we have to align financial incentives. We have to pay for outcomes, not volume. So in conclusion, reform is real, it is possible, it is achievable. Medicaid expansion is critical to achieving it, and we are here as hospitals saying we're ready to be to partner on that journey. Thank you.
And thank you. And are there questions? Seeing none, let's go to John Gagne. Leave it. And
I'm going to be about 2 minutes.
Okay.
Representative Seaton, members of the committee, I'm a longtime Juneau resident. I am just here to express my view that the people have very firmly endorsed Medicare expansion. If you look at the last election, an incumbent Democratic senator was voted down. The Republicans remain strong control of both houses of the legislature. Yet, a Republican governor, the only Republican governor in the United States to lose election, was defeated. And I think one of the big issues between now Governor Walker and then Governor Parnell was on Medicaid expansion. The former governor opposed it vociferously, and Governor Walker was very strongly in favor of it. Obviously, there were other issues as well, but I think it's safe to say that that was, if not the primary issue, one of the primary issues. So I think the people have spoken on this, and I think if the legislature does not produce a bill on Medicaid expansion, that you will be flouting the will of the electorate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now we'll go to Allison Curry. Allison.
My name is Allison Curry. I am a Juneau resident as well, District 33, and I'm here to express my general support Medicaid expansion and reform as well. My education and career background is in social work. It is an injustice to me that today, if you are a childless adult without a disability in Alaska, making less than $20,000 a year, which equals to just under $10 an hour, you have no affordable health care coverage available to you. Through my role as a social worker, I have seen individuals work multiple jobs to make ends meet and forgo necessary health care in order to pay utility bills, rent, or even buy groceries. I believe that healthcare is a basic human right, and no one should have to be, or no one should have to choose between seeking medical care or paying rent. Access to affordable healthcare should not depend on who you are, where you live, or your income level. Medicaid expansion would ensure that all Alaskans have health care coverage for preventative care, which in turn would reduce the amount of ER visits and allow currently uninsured individuals to remain productive members of an Alaskan economy. Reforms to our state's Medicaid program are necessary to make sure we have the most effective and efficient system available, and evaluation and reevaluation should continually occur. However, expansion does not need to wait for reform. Our state cannot afford to wait to expand Medicaid. So thank you all, Mr. Chair and the committee members, as well as to Commissioner Davidson, Governor Walker, and all the healthcare policy experts sitting behind me for their tireless efforts to implement a smart program that will benefit all Alaskans.
Thank you very much. Melissa Engel. And next up will be Corinza Bolt or Bott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. I am Melissa Engel, and I am here today to testify in support of HB 148 and to express my support of Governor Walker's and Commissioner Davidson's tireless efforts to expand eligibility to Medicaid and to reform Alaska's Medicaid program to benefit all Alaskans. As a United Methodist pastor in Juneau, I am looking at what this bill does for people of Alaska and the ethics we embody as the state of Alaska. I believe that HB 148 is a step in the right direction toward embodying compassion and love to ethics that I know in my Christian tradition as agape, or Christian love. In my job as youth pastor between five churches, I meet families and individuals who are low income and would benefit from Medicaid expansion and reform. In my job, I also see people reach out to help people who are in the low income bracket as much as they can. However, the body of people in a church can only do so much. We can sometimes help someone financially, but not every faith community can. We cannot provide health care or go between a person and their health care and their insurance company. Therefore, I ask that our government reflect the needs of the people and, in the spirit of kindness, give people access to the health care they deserve so that they can get a so-called leg up, so they might experience transformation in their lives and from their current low-income bracket that makes it difficult enough to afford education and groceries to get another leg up in their health, whomever they are. So I ask the representatives of the people of Alaska to stand up and care for their people in the spirit of kindness. When else do you or anyone else really have the chance to be kind? Outside of legislative session? Are we not called as people to not compartmentalize our lives, but to be authentic and kind in every part of our lives? As civil rights activist John E. Lewis wisely posed, if not us, then who? If not now, then when? The answer can be us and now, and it starts with you. Thank you for your time, and please support HB 148.
And thank you very much for your testimony. And now we have Carenza. Good.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I come to you today, I walk up to you today thanks to Medicaid, and I'm smiling at you thanks to Medicaid. I wasn't always poor. One day in 2006, I was driving home for lunch from my job at the Office of the Governor, Division of Elections, and a young woman on a cell phone ran into me at 55 miles an hour. My life ended. My brain no longer talked to my body. And so I went through AFLA, FINLA, COBRA, all of these insurance companies, finally becoming, going through the review of Social Security, 100% and permanently disabled. In 2010, it took, and so it was retroactive to 2009. Then you learn what Social Security doesn't cover. What Medicaid does cover, however, and these are the two most important things I would like you to please protect as you go through this reform, physical therapy. Social Security does not cover physical therapy. It also does not cover restorative dental work. Those two things allowed me to heal myself, learn how to prevent injury, further injury, and get off of pain medication in 2012-2013. I am now on the Ticket to Work program through Social Security. I have done an internship with Senator Mark Begich here in Juneau. I am succeeding because of Medicaid and a huge part of it. So please, when you consider that, consider all of this. I appreciate the big dollars and the staffing and all of these things that really matter to the state and to people that have money. I wasn't always poor. I don't plan on always being poor, and thank goodness I'm here now. I'm a student at UAS, Alaska Native Studies. I could even introduce myself in Tlingit to go with the language bill that passed. I am proud to be an Alaskan, and I hope that you guys would put a face to the Medicaid reform, because it is important, and I would hate to see anybody be denied the same opportunities that I've been given, because it is a blessing. It is amazing, and it's really hard. I would love to talk more, but it's a long, confusing road. So please just remember that it is a really good thing, and it makes a difference. Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. And we've run out of time today, and we got through all the people that had signed up. I guess we do have three people online. I didn't realize that. Is it Verna? Bernie Borner, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
We can. Can you go ahead with your testimony? We are running low on time, though.
Yes. Honorable Chairman Seaton and members of the committee, my name is Brene Brenner, President and CEO of the Alaska Native House Board. Thank you for the opportunity to voice our support on House Bill 148. The Alaska Native Health Board serves as a statewide organization for the Alaska Tribal Health System, which serves over 145,000 Alaska Natives and American Indians, and veterans more non-Natives as an integral part of Alaska's statewide public health system. It is frequent that tribal programs are equated with health insurance for tribal people in Alaska. However, the ATS is not health insurance for individuals. There is not a guaranteed set of benefits for a premium paid. In fact, the Alaska Tribal Health System has been chronically underfunded since its inception, and most tribal programs across the state must ration care. Not expanding Medicaid carries incredible opportunity costs that will not only impede economic growth, but more importantly, will result in higher costs to the statewide system and sadly higher morbidity and mortality. The IHS, the Indian Health Service sources of funding, are indeed below the level of need, and they are finite. Therefore, tribes have been innovative in designing and developing programs that increase resources, and just like our non-tribal counterparts, it depends on third-party billings to extend our capacity to provide care. Heartbreakingly, however, the Alaska Natives suffer the highest rates of uninsurance and poverty in our program, and our programs are still forced to ration care. I provide in my written comments a personal example of the impacts of ration care. Tribal programs are forced to direct resources to cover uncompensated care and therefore not able to apply those resources towards capacity building. Rationing care means that diagnosis and treatments are delayed, diseases further progress, and treatment is more costly and outcomes are poorer. Medicaid expansion will alleviate the pressure on the health system and allow for more resources to be dedicated to capacity building and innovation. In fiscal year 2012, Alaska Natives made up nearly 40% of Alaska's Medicaid recipients, and payments to those tribal programs, however, only totaled about 16.4%. If that percentage was pushed up to 20 or 30%, the dollar savings to Alaska's general fund would have been $25.8 million and $97.3 million, respectively. Tribes are ready to work with the state and the federal government on developing ways to better utilize the Alaska Tribal Health System. The ability and extent for the Alaska Tribal Health System to innovate and demonstrate new programs is impacted by the fact that the system suffers from underfunding and fiscal pressures. It is often in a state of ration care that does result in delays in diagnosis, which then leads to the higher costs and poor outcomes. Leaving Medicaid expansion dollars on the table is costing lives. That is on your and my shoulders as leaders. It limits our ability to innovate and develop sustainable programs and to help improve the health status and quality of life for Alaskans. And we collectively, as leaders, have to own that. I present here before you, imploring you to pass House Bill 148. Thank you very much for your time.
And thank you for your testimony. We have three more people to go. The committee is willing to stay in. Michael Durzian?
Durzian.
Would you go ahead and repeat your name there? It was a little weak. And
I was away from the mic. Can you hear me?
Oh, we sure can. Would you go ahead and book your testimony? Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm testifying on behalf of myself. I actually was a state licensed insurance agent, California license OC55335. So I do consider myself to be an expert in the field. Quickly, the laundry list, of course, is that I'm in favor of Medicare, Medicaid expansion. It'll create 4,000 jobs. It'll create $1.2 billion in wages and salaries in Alaska, jobs that are much needed in Alaska. It'll save $6 million in budget savings, and it'll ensure, you know, an estimated 40,000 people that don't have health insurance right now. It's not ethical to leave these people without health insurance, number one. And number two, it's good economics to expand Medicaid because these people, if they don't have insurance, will go to the emergency room, and it'll cost a lot. It'll cost the hospital a lot more to get these people well. It actually, and thereby, it will actually lower everybody's health insurance premiums by passing Medicaid expansion. I do applaud the governor for trying to push this bill through. I think it's the right move. And I'd just like to add that many Republican governors in some other states have expanded Medicaid to include John Kasich of Ohio, Chris Christie of New Jersey, and I believe Kentucky as well. I appreciate the physician that testified earlier. I know she said there were some issues with Medicaid. And briefly, these issues are easily fixed by just increasing Medicaid payments and fixing some of the problems. As an expert in the field of health insurance, people have to realize insurance is nothing but a big game. I do get VA insurance right now. It's public insurance. I think everybody should get public insurance. I am an advocate of Medicaid and Medicare for all, just like every other industrialized nation has, except for Switzerland, who regulates their insurance industry very, very tightly. The overhead for Medicaid and Medicare, I believe, is 2% as compared to private insurance, which is, the overhead is anywhere from 10 to 20%. Insurance companies, briefly, when it comes to the big claims especially, are in the business of denying people coverage, not by covering them. They lose money when they pay out big claims. Lastly, the reason I really believe that we should expand Medicaid is, you know, if we had Medicare and Medicaid for all, I don't know if everybody realizes it, but everybody's health insurance, health and costs would actually go down. People say, well, if everybody has Medicaid, we'll have to raise taxes, but I would submit to you that everybody's insurance payments right now represent a tax, a second tax.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
I think that's about the end of my testimony, unless you guys have any questions.
Don't see any. Thank you very much for your comments. Now we'll go to Robin Smith. Robin Smith, are you on?
Yes, I am. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Seaton, and the other representatives here in the room for the opportunity to testify. As a business owner...
And Robin, would you identify yourself and who you represent for the record?
I apologize.
That's fine.
Yes, my name is Robin Smith, and I'm a business owner here in Anchorage, and I am very concerned about the future in Alaska. According to Northern Economics, the Alaska economy is heading towards a recession, and one of the few bright spots on the horizon is Medicaid expansion. You know, with the drop in oil prices, we need to cut the budget. But if we cut the budget too much, it will drive us into a recession. There is little in sight that will bring us any major additional income. But Medicaid expansion is the only option currently that will bring $1 billion to Alaska's economy over the next 5 years. If we do go into a recession, businesses are going to be hugely impacted, and we'll be looking for ways to increase the bottom line for the company. One thing may have to be, if we go into a recession, cutting health care, eliminating our health care insurance for our employees. Currently, the fees from emergency room visits by the uninsured, as mentioned by others, are passed on to Alaska businesses and individuals in the form of higher premiums for health care. This is a major issue when we even consider additional hires. Our health care costs have dramatically risen over the past 30 years. So by expanding Medicaid, the legislature would be helping to reduce our businesses' health care costs, and it would improve our profits in this very tentative economic time. In addition, I would say if Medicaid does not prove to save the state money, then, you know, we can cancel it in the future. I would say that 2 years of health care for people is better than no amount of health care for people. I thank you for the opportunity for testifying. And I really do think we have to take the future economy into serious consideration. So please expand Medicaid and pass HB 148. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And then we have Andrew Smallwood in Cordova. Are you there, Andrew?
Yes, good evening. I'm Andrew Smallwood. I'm a commercial fisherman from Cordova. And I'm on Medicare, so I'm not testifying on my own behalf. But I would urge you to ask your colleagues to support and pass House Bill 148. The state has in the past refused Medicaid expansion in an attempt to hinder the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And I guess that's fair enough. But consider this. Anchorage, for most procedures, is the most expensive medical care in the nation, and arguably in the world. And consider also that an uninsured patient in Anchorage will receive a medical, or will be required to pay a medical bill, generally about double what an insured patient would pay. So Alaska, in this respect, is indeed exceptional. And then further consider that coastal Alaska has the highest percentage of uninsured people in the nation. This is a pretty dismal situation that the state confronts. And so anything that would improve this is to be preferred to the status quo. And in a time of declining state revenues, it makes absolute sense to accept Medicaid expansion. The Affordable Care Act needs to be considered in a separate issue, but if it is the intention of the majority to block implementation, then I hope you have an alternative plan. For working and middle-income people in the state, the present system is broken. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew, for your testimony. We have one other person who's not going to be here, I believe, on Saturday. Jeff, Jesse, were you going to testify today? Didn't have you on the list here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Medical Trust Authority. And I'd like to focus on the very first line of the legislative intent that the governor has presented in this bill. The current Medicaid program is not sustainable. Reform is not an option. You know, the trust is a long-term thinker. It's untenable from our position in terms of our beneficiaries to continue to let the Medicaid house of cards continue to get bigger. At some point it collapses, and it's going to take our beneficiaries down with it. And so as Becky Holtberg from ASHNA testified earlier, we are committed to working with you and the department and the governor in ensuring that reform is front and center in the efforts that we all undertake in order to bring the Medicaid budget into a sustainable level. Now, certainly from our beneficiary standpoint, Medicaid expansion is absolutely critical. Whether you're looking at people that are homeless, many of whom suffer from substance abuse disorder and mental health issues, to the 65% of inmates in corrections that have a mental health diagnosis, or the 80% of inmates that have a substance use disorder diagnosis, expanding Medicaid as a way to get them the services they need to get off the street or stay out of jail is not only just good health sense, but it's good economic sense. There's a lot of conversation in this building about recidivism and not building another prison. Well, I'll tell you, you are not going to keep people out of prison if you don't support their recovery. And you can either pay for that out of the general fund, which is what you do now, or we can find a way to do expansion and get the federal government to help us with that effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we were able to get through our testifiers today and thank the committee for staying late to make sure that we could do that. We will be back on Saturday, and we will be looking at 3 o'clock, and I think we had 3 to 6, right? And so we're intending for being here from 3 to 6 on Saturday, which will be mostly public testimony. If we have time, we will also have amendments that we'll put on the table at that time, and if they are generally agreeable, we may adopt some of those. Oops, I'm supposed to stop. And so, anyway, look forward to seeing everybody on Sunday or Saturday. And Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in preparation for amendments, you've distributed amendments to the committee, and we've had those. But if there were other members of the committee that had amendments, would those be distributed prior to the Saturday meeting so we would have time to review them?
They would. What we would like to do is get those amendments to my office as soon as possible. And not only will we distribute the committee members, we'll put them on as proposed amendments on to the website so that the public can know what we are going to consider. Remember, those proposed amendments that are on the website or that the committee receives have not been adopted. They're there for discussion. They may be all offered. Some may not be offered, or some may be further amended. And so this gives the public and everyone a chance to talk about and suggest tweaks to those amendments as well. So thank you very much for coming. Our extended meeting here is over at 5:20.